I have the Chronicles of the Warlands and also what's affectionately known as the Star Series. My very first book is War Prize, which was re-released in 2011. This is characters with character. We're going to talk about how you can add things to your characters to make them more attractive to the reader, or less attractive depending on your motto, your motivation. I'm going to have everybody introduce themselves, then we'll get started.
My name is Dylan Bertolo. I have a few short stories and a couple of novels published. I've been published by Daw. Later this year, I will have some Battletech fiction that will be published, and will also be published by Paizo and Pathfinder. I do have a table down in Authors Avenue, my own little shameless plug there. And that's pretty much it.
Hi, my name is Gregory Wilson. I'm an associate professor of English at St. John's University in Queens, New York. I teach courses in fantasy and science fiction and creative writing, among others. I'm also an author. My first novel came out a couple of years back. Next two are being shopped. I'm working on my fourth. I have a short story that just came out in an anthology called When the Villain Comes Home, which was edited by Ed Greenwood and Gabriel Harbowy. Has people like Mercedes Lackey and Todd McCaffrey and Jay Lake and other cool people like that. And if you actually go down to the Dragon Moon Press booth down in the exhibit hall, you will find it. I'm very proud of that story, and there's a ton of really great stories in the anthology, so I highly recommend it. I am also co-editing an anthology on speculative fiction and politics with John Helfers, who's a member of the symposium here, Hugo nominee, and actually with some authors that are here as well. And then last, I run a show, a podcast called Speculate, the podcast for writers, readers, and fans, along with Brad Bollier, also in the symposium, also a speculative fiction author with the series out from Nightshade. We discuss the work and interview authors from all aspects of the speculative fiction field. Most recently got done with work on Saladin Ahmed and got a chance to interview Betsy Wolheim from Daw Books. Have also interviewed Brent Weeks and Brandon Sanderson and Pat Rothfuss and Kiz Johnson and James Patrick Kelly and a whole bunch of other cool people. And you can find that at SpeculateSF.com.
Erin?
My name is Erin Evans. I write for Wizards of the Coast. Currently, I'm working on the Brimstone Angels series, of which the first book is out, and the next book, Lesser Evils, will be out in December. I also was, until a year or two ago, one of the Forgotten Realms line editors, so I've worked on both sides of creating good characters.
Cool. All right, so as the moderator, I get to ask the tough questions. And let's start with, what's your favorite way, let's start with something basic. How does a character start for you? How do you get the idea for a character from the very first? And let's concentrate for right now on the hero, or, because I write romance, the heroine, depending on which one's more important to you. Erin?
I think it comes a lot of different ways. My favorites have been, they come out of problems, frankly, which I think is a little bit indicative of working in tie-in. Because you're working in a world that already exists, you're bouncing off something that's already there. Which, if you think about it, is good when you're working also in the real world or with other sort of established tropes. I think it's a skill everybody should kind of be aware of. My first book, The Godcatcher, has a character, Nestrix, who is either a dragon trapped in a woman's body by the spell plague, or a crazy murderer. And it's not necessarily completely clear until you get further down in the book, which is which. That came out when I was working as an editor with an author wanting to do, wanting to do a spell-scarred dragon. And if you're not familiar with Forgotten Realms, for 4th edition, there was this very large realm-shaking event called the spell plague, which basically turned magic upside down and made things very difficult for everybody, and imbued certain people who it interacted with special powers, and said, do we want to put characters forward that are this overpowered? We'd have to think of things that might, actually be more of a hindrance than a help. Like, they can shape change. Maybe they're just trapped in, okay, no, you can't do that because I want to do that. Which fortunately was what he wanted to do. So another one that I really love, I did a short story for Wizards called The Resurrection Agent, which is based on the idea of a spy who is exploiting the resurrection spell. So her spy master will cut off her little finger. She goes in, she gets information, she goes, oh no, you caught me! And they kill her, and then they resurrect her from the little finger, and they go, oh, it was him. But then her spy master dies. So I like to start with that sort of germ of a solution, almost, and go, what is that person like, and what do they want, and what do they need, and how does the world work against them? I think those are my favorites, those ones that come together that way.
Yeah, I agree with some of that. A good deal of that, actually. Characters, for me, the best characters are ones that come in sort of contradistinction to other things, themes, or other characters, or the conditions, as Aaron was talking about, of the world around them in which they function. One of my novels that's currently out on submission is a novel about a religious assassin who works for a group that believes that they are sort of tasked by their god to assassinate those who are against the wills of their god. I know it's crazy. Who would imagine that would be the case? That religions would do that. But the whole premise of it is this character begins in one way working exclusively for this organization, and as the core of the book proceeds, begins to realize that what he thought were the reasons for what he was doing were not really the reasons he was doing, and ends up in some ways being opposed to that same organization. My inspiration for that came from an 80s TV show called The Equalizer, some of you may be familiar with,
yeah.
In which this guy, played by Edward Woodward, leaves the agency, clearly the CIA, and essentially spends most of the TV series trying to atone for some of the things that he felt that he did wrong by using his special skills. And I've always been fascinated with the idea of a character where all of the resources of the state or the organization or some massive bureaucracy are all arrayed against this person, but this one person is uniquely qualified to be able to balance off those resources. Another show like that is the old BBC show called The Prisoner, in which you had this guy who was put on this island, and all of this is about him getting off this island, and it would drive anybody else nuts, but this specific guy, played by Patrick McGoohan, I believe, is so absolutely dedicated to his craft and is so good at what he does that he is capable, in a way, of balancing out the incredible array of resources that have been placed against him. Jason Bourne, another example of that same sort of thing. So all of these characters are characters that come out of situations. They come out of the world in which they function. And so for me, the best way to work with a character is, what are the problems they face, but what are the things that define them in the world in which they function? And for that character, my character being called Greyshade, the thing that defines him, in a way, is first his abject obedience to this order, and later his resistance to it. This sense that as he goes on, a sort of deeper part of him, even before he joined the order, becomes clear to him, which is defiance, resistance, objecting to authority that does things just because it thinks that it can. And that thing where he begins to realize, I remember that. Before all of this started happening, I remember when I was that person that believed in that. That character trait eventually bubbles to the fore. So for me, the way that I usually develop characters is as opposed to problems, as opposed to conditions in the world, or as opposed to a theme. In fact, one little quick thing, the short story that I mentioned in that anthology came because I was really interested with talking about, I have a 4-year-old daughter who's the most wonderful girl ever, and so I wanted to write about fathers and daughters. And in a lot of ways, my character, Jaketh, who is he's called a warden. He's a bounty hunter in the service of the emperor who sort of essentially goes out and brings these people back to justice that have committed crimes against the empire. But I wanted to see what would happen when he had to operate with children, with, in this particular case, a Pressul, a young baby of a race that is completely opposed to the empire for which Jaketh works. And so for me, the character sprang from what kind of character would be produced by this empire? How do I play out this theme within this story? So there, the character developed out of the course of the theme. And I think that's the way a lot of authors, Charles Dickens especially, for example, characters were developed for him out of themes. So it's, for me, in relation to themes, worlds, conditions around.
You're up next.
Now I have to talk. For me, a large part of it all comes down to how I choose to write stories. And one of the big things that I always wind up doing with my stories is I come up with a lot of what-if scenarios. And I come up with, in my mind, what if there was this one aspect that was different? One of my short stories that was recently published dealt with time travel. The whole theme of the anthology was about time travel. And in the story, what I was thinking of was, I was like, okay, we've done time travel a lot, but what if there was someone who had the ability to time travel, but he could only time travel back about 2 or 3 seconds at most, maybe only 1 second. What would that kind of character be like? What would that character do? And from there is usually where my characters come from. So very similar to what Greg was saying, what I try to come up with is I try to come up with that twist or that element which is different and which interests me. And then from there the character is born, because there's a lot of implications that come into that. You can't just assume that somebody who is in that situation, who has that ability, or is who is exposed to that environment, is going to be just a regular, normal person from off the street. It's going to affect everything about their life. And I think that that is where it starts to get really interesting. And one of the things, touching on a slightly different subject about writing, one of the things is that I do a lot of character background. Whenever I sit down and write a story, even a short story, I will have pages that I write down for my own reference of that character and where they came from, what happened to them, how they grew up, what their life was like. That doesn't actually go into the story, but I need that information to make the character real, to make the character actually have depth. And that is honestly one of my favorite parts of writing, is figuring out all of the nuances and what all of this means. And so for me, that's where characters, whether they're heroes or villains, come from.
I write romance. So invariably, when I'm coming up with a character for a book, I've usually got two characters, and usually it's a man and a woman. And I have to kind of concentrate, because the core of their relationship is going to be the core of the book. There might be lots of other things going on in the world around them and behind them, but their relationship is really at the center of my story. And as a result, that conflict has to be there for me when I very first start out. What is the conflict between the hero and the heroine, and how are they going to overcome it? And if you notice, we seem to have a theme going here. It's the conflict that is the fascinating thing about the character, really, for the most part. You can have an absolute wonderfully flawed, scarred guy with two swords and an awesome horse. But if that guy does not have a problem or a conflict to overcome, then to a certain extent, he's sort of boring after about three pages. So the thing that that I try to concentrate on is the conflict between my my romantic couple, and also the conflict that's happening around them that is going to affect their relationship. But that's also because of the genre I write in. I write in romance, and that's going to have to be at the core of my book. So now that we've established how you first come across your character, what kinds of additional things do you give characters to make them more interesting? Do you give them scars? Do you give them flaws?
Well, I mean, they need
cool horse.
A cool horse.
Two swords.
We had some shorthand when I was an editor, and there was a term we used. There was cool sword, ugly scar. So yeah. If your characters, if what's interesting about your characters, he has this really cool sword. Your character's not interesting. That sword is interesting for a sword. But your character's personality has to have something going on that makes them the center of the story. The way they interact with other characters, the way they deal with that conflict. At the same time, you say, well, what's your character's flaw? What makes them, a broken person who's to put themselves back together at a certain level? And you say, oh, he has this really ugly scar. Unless that scar reminds him of the horrible battle where he lost his brother or something, that's not a flaw.
Yeah. A scar does not create nuance.
But it's not like ding. It can be
depth.
He can still
see?
Have
and
the
longer the scar, the more depth.
He can still have the scar. There just has to be something else there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, your character, they can't be perfect. They have to be, hurting or anxious or just really driven to solve something in some way. And I mean, when you talk about flaws, it gets really messy because it can be a lot of little things, and it's really personal to that character, whatever it's going to be.
Well, but perfect characters are boring.
Oh yes.
I mean, horribly boring. I mean, that is one. I was reading a story about a comic book writer, and I forget the comic book writer's name, but he was talking about how it was really hard to write Superman comics. Because Superman has so much power, and he's such this embodiment of being perfect, that it's really hard to write interesting stories. And I, on the side, in my spare time, I do stage combat. And one of the things that we do in stage combat that we talk about is that you can't have, whether it's the good guy or the bad guy, just going out and always beating everybody up because it's boring. You will lose your audience 10 seconds into the fight if the good guy's just always knocking everybody down. It's not interesting. And it works the same with characters. Your characters are not going to be interesting if they are a paragon of virtue. You know, now, if they are so virtuous that they're oblivious and a little bit stupid, well, then they can be interesting.
You know, I have to say, in my first drafts of my books, I'm really nice to my characters because I like them. They don't make mistakes. They go out for lunch. They tell jokes. You know, yeah, okay, there's swords and some fighting, and I put all that in. But then after the first draft, I go back into the second draft, and I go, oh, dear God, what was I thinking? And then I start throwing rocks at them. Because the tougher you make it on them, the more interesting the story becomes. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you kind of do a Tolkien. You set wargs on them, you run them up your tree, and then you set it on fire.
And you make them run up the wrong tree.
And you make them run up the wrong tree.
Always the wrong tree.
Slowly bends.
Always the wrong tree, yeah.
You know, oh, and that's when it gets more interesting. And you can do that in the second draft. Also, it really helps if characters turn to one another and go, oh, that's okay, Bob. I know you made a mistake, and it's all right. It's much more interesting if you go, what were you thinking? You have to have even friends argue. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Mm-hmm. I can't take this anymore.
Greg, yeah. Aaron's up next.
She hasn't thrown rocks at me yet.
No, you think about it. Sometimes during the fellowship, you know, you kind of wonder why somebody isn't turning to somebody else and going, what the hell are we doing out here?
I would like to say, you can do the very sarcastic, that's okay.
Well, but what I'm discovering is being kind to them in the first draft means I have to do more work in the second draft. So, you know, any kind of obstacle that you can add to your character, even it's so much as, you know, just a normal bad day, it just adds to the layers of the complexity of the character.
Yeah, and the obstacles, not all obstacles are created equal for these characters. You know, a lot of the way to get around, Richard Lee Byers, who's written Superman stuff, has talked about this problem that you were mentioning before, Dylan, and one of the ways to get around that problem in the case of Superman is to make the conflicts that he faces internal ones. They're decisions that he has to make, right? It's one of the reasons why in the series of movies, in my view, the best one is Superman 2, which is where he ends up giving up his power. This is a spoiler, but if you haven't seen it by now, my God. I had someone once that I brought up something from like the 1970s. Like, you know, I haven't seen that movie yet. I'm like, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know. spoiler is full of stars. Okay, like I'm sorry. In the second Superman movie, Superman ends up giving up his powers. He does so voluntarily because he loves Lois Lane, he wants to be human, and he is always torn between these worlds, right, of Krypton, which is obviously his native planet, and then his adopted planet of Earth. And how is he going to find some difference between the two of them, right? How is he going to decide which one to ally himself with? Now, later on, all these terrible things happen. Zod comes, and all these other, you know, prisoners who have been imprisoned, and now they're on Earth, and they're Kryptonians, so they have lots of powers too. And that's all action and fun. But the real tension in that movie, the real thing that makes it interesting is him deciding, am I going to give up my humanity? Am I going to give up my opportunity to be with Lois Lane? Am I going to give up my love for her all so that I can save the planet Earth? And it's deeply compelling because it is an internal conflict that you buy. And that's the thing which makes characters, to me, by far the most interesting. My character, Grayshade, that I mentioned before, is a badass assassin. He can take people down. He is all about, I mean, he's awesome. But he has serious internal conflicts about, at the beginning, not about morality, but about sort of a weariness, a kind of how much longer do I have to do this sort of thing? And as time goes on and he begins to realize this massive conspiracy and all these other things happen, he, like the ones I mentioned before, Robert McCall, the character in The Equalizer, or Jason Bourne, all of these characters begin to realize that no matter how badass they are, it doesn't change the way that they feel about themselves internally. In fact, I would argue that what makes Jason Bourne such an interesting movie character is the fact that we are driven by his internal search, not just for who he is in the first movie, and a little bit for the other movies, but also into some terms atoning for what it is that he's done in breaking away from this agency and literally making a new life. That makes all the action matter. all the stuff that happens to him matters because you care about his internal conflict and about this poor guy. Like, you're really saying this poor guy about a guy who kills people for a living, right? And yet you realize he was brainwashed and he was sort of given the wrong reasons and he thought he was being a patriot, but they lied to him. And all these other things kind of develop the character that's being constructed for you, and that's why I think those things work so well. Another example quickly from the movies is the James Bond. When they rebooted James Bond and the way they went to Casino Royale, I think the reason those movies work better than a lot of the way, and I'm a James Bond fan, but the James Bond movie, I think, had gotten tired. And the reason it got tired is it became all show. It became all tie and shaken, not stirred, and that kind of thing, and not about the internal conflict for a guy who was always this close to being a mass killer. And the only difference between him and the murderer is the fact that, you know, England says you're working for the Queen, right? That's really the only difference between the two of them. And I think Daniel Craig and that whole reboot portrays that side of him. That's what makes him interesting. So conflicts can be internal as well, and one of the things I try to do in my characters as I develop them is to produce more competing motivations, more things that are going to pull them in one direction or the other, and other characters come in, other external events happen. But the external events only matter for the character insofar as they affect the way the character feels about his or her place in the world around them. So.
Well, and the big thing that I think that comes down to it, whether you're talking movies, video games, stories, whatever, the big thing that pulls me in when it comes to characters is that I believe that they exist, that they are real. That is something that makes a huge difference. When characters are actually wrestling with decisions, when characters are not quite sure how to react, when you see a character change, one of my favorite examples in one of my favorite books is Dune. With Paul Atreides, Muad'Dib. His evolution, when he starts out, I mean, if you take a step back and look at the book, when he starts out, he's this somewhat innocent, definitely cocky, noble kid who goes through a metamorphosis that by the end of the book, he honestly believes, but still has doubts, that he's a living prophet. And you can see his evolution, and you can see how he makes that transition. It's not just like, you know, okay, you turn one page and, oh, okay, yeah, I'm the prophet. No, he has all of these debates, he has all of these decisions, this anguish. He feels real. Even though it's a fantastical situation, it's a fantastical world, I can believe that somebody who was in that situation would make that evolution, and I can see how they would go from step to step and get where they are. And that is what can really make that final character so much more compelling. It works really well also when you see characters slowly becoming villains, when they don't just start out as villains, but when you see them, like, villains are not made, villains are not born, villains are made. You know, somebody doesn't just become a villain. It takes real villains, it's small steps. I mean, yes, you have your psychotics, yes, you have your people who are just quite bluntly, messed up in the head and the wiring's not right, but your real villains, your good villains, they take steps to get where they are, and it's small steps. It's little things like the end justifies the means, and then taking that one step further until eventually you're down this path. And to me, that is what will make a villain character much more interesting, because then they're believable, then they have depth. And then sometimes, the book Phantom by Susan Kay explains, for anybody familiar with Phantom of the Opera, Phantom by Susan Kay explains how Eric gets to where he is. It is a prequel to Phantom of the Opera, and it explains how he gets there and how he has these somewhat twisted views that make him do all of the things that he does in Phantom of the Opera, to the point where even though he's the villain, you feel genuinely bad for him because you feel like he was just given a rotten hand in life, and you can totally see how he got there.
Another example of that very quickly, which I've used before at the symposium, is John Gardner's brilliant book, Grendel. Which takes the monster from Beowulf and gives you, essentially retells the tale but from the monster's perspective and gives you a deep understanding of Grendel and does so sympathetically but not sort of unreservedly. I mean, it's not just here's why Grendel's awesome. It, in a lot of ways, it shows Grendel's internal conflict, but it also shows Grendel being very small and petty at times. It shows him being very evil at times. It shows him being deeply conflicted at other times, and it makes, you ought to see what it does to Beowulf. The character of Beowulf does not come off like a great hero. It's an extraordinary act of characterization, in part because it adds depth. Now, here's the trick in Gardner, which I think is important, and sort of reflects what you were just talking about with Phantom. To do this, Gardner had to have a perfect understanding of the way that Grendel is portrayed in the original epic poem Beowulf. This portrayal does not do violence to that portrayal, because in Beowulf the poem, all you see is Grendel the ravening monster. In this book, Grendel is a ravening monster, but what you get here is his point of view, his perspective, his motivations, why he does what he does. And that develops the character of Grendel such that you go, oh, but it's not, here's what if Beowulf were really different. Nobody knew Beowulf better than John Gardner, who was an academic. The difference is that Gardner was able to flesh out the character of Grendel so that you could say, this is a plausible motivation. So much so that you could end up, if you didn't sort of think about it very carefully, sort of thinking in your head, well, then Grendel did this in the poem, didn't he? Because, you know, Gardner does such a good job of sort of filling it out. Another example of that is Paradise Lost. You know, Satan is incredibly filled out and developed, and yet what Milton does not really, for the most part, do violence to biblical text or verse, because Milton, again, knew it backwards, forwards, and sideways. What he does is provide motivation, and it's that reason that Milton comes this close to actually being more of a fan of Satan than he is of God. Satan comes off as the classic hero. Satan comes off as the one who has been wronged. Satan is the one that you feel, this guy's all right. I mean, he's striding across hell with his massy shield, and he's like, let's get going, and everyone's like, yeah, and then you're like, wait, this is Satan. Why am I rooting for this guy? How did that happen? And Milton is a great, Milton was a major, major Christian who was flirting with the devil, quite literally, and finally had to sort of pull himself off from it, as does so by making Satan into the way that much evil ends up becoming, and that is very petty and small. So by the time we get to the end of that poem, Satan has basically come down to doing parlor tricks and fooling around with Adam and Eve and stuff like that, but not doing what you imagined at the beginning. But the point is that all of that is not doing violence to the original concept of the character. It's developing the character. It's providing motivation and background and story to the character, and I think that kind of thing is incredibly interesting when that happens in this world.
Another great example is Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Yeah.
I read a wonderful essay. Most people, when they read Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, first of all, if you haven't read it, Frankenstein is not the name of the monster, it's the name of the doctor. It's just referred to as the
spoiler.
Monster or Frankenstein's monster. Yeah, spoiler. But I read a wonderful essay that most people, when they read it, you know, like, oh, okay, Frankenstein's the monster, especially if you're modern culture and you've been raised up on, like, you know, the horror films, even the classic horror films, it's like, oh, Frankenstein's a bad guy. But if you read the book, and I read this wonderful essay on it, it goes through, and there are two ways you can read Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And one is, yes, the monster is a monster. But the other way that you can read it is that the monster is completely misunderstood and is thrown in a world where no one trusts him, where people show him violence when they first meet him, and that's all he's exposed to, and he reacts the way that you would expect a scared animal to react.
Especially because Frankenstein is such a jackass.
Yeah,
jerk. I teach that book, and my students in that whole time are just like, "Why? Well, this guy's, I hope, can the, does the monster kill him by 200? Because I hate this guy." And I was like, so yeah, you're right.
But and it's just, it's a wonderful piece because you can read it both ways. You read through the whole thing and you can take completely different views of it. And for that reason, I think it works as a great example of what we've been talking about.
And it's very important that your villains are as fleshed out as your heroes.
Yeah.
You may never show the backstory in your novel, short story, whatever, but you know it and it will reflect in your writing. When Dylan says he works up the backstories of his characters, he doesn't necessarily give you all that information, but he's using it to flesh it out as he writes, and it will add something as he goes along. So now I'm going to switch the discussion to something a little bit more technical, because we're all writing fantasy. How do you keep track of characters? How do you keep track of the number of people you have, what their hair color, eye color, religious affiliations, how do you keep track of that? Do you make an Excel spreadsheet? Do you create little cheat sheets for yourself? What do you do, Aaron?
I keep it all in my head. I know that's not the best idea, but I just hold it all in my head. which has been, I'll have to go back and look sometimes. Like, my main character in Brimstone Angels has a complete heterochromia, and one of her eyes, these are normal colors for tieflings. It's going to sound terrible in Mary Search, but they're very normal. A gold eye and a silver eye. And I got to, like my third book, and I'm like, wait, which one's the silver one? I don't remember. But I know to search for it, right? So, yeah, a spreadsheet, it could be helpful. But then the thing I find with keeping notes like that, they get really unwieldy just because of all the little things you turn out you have to remember.
Yeah.
I caught one between this and the next book, Lesser Evils. I shouldn't even tell you guys this. I should just let it slide. but in this book, she's drinking a cup of tea, and the tea burns her tongue a little. And then the next book, I played with the idea that tieflings have fire resistance in the game. So she just knocks back a really hot cup of tea, and this guy's like, are you okay? She's like, it's fine. Doesn't bother. Yeah. And then I'm like, oh crap, I made her drink that tea. I'm gonna have to make up something for
because I built up an immunity to
it. It had acid in it. The tea had acid in it.
It had cold iron in it, yeah.
No, they're cool with that one.
You know, I was keeping it in my head too, and then I wrote book one, which is War Prize. So I'm halfway through War Sworn. I'm doing the edits for War Prize, and I'm sitting with a friend, going with the ruler, checking all the words, and all of a sudden I get said an obscenity. I shouldn't swear in these things, and I always do. I said, holy shit! And he goes, what's wrong? And I go, so-and-so's alive! And he goes, well, what's wrong with that? I said, I killed him in the first book! So after that, I started keeping track.
As far as keeping it in your head, or even if you write down the notes, something's going to come up. Thank God for search functions.
Yeah. Find and replace.
Find and replace.
Yeah. Find and replace is not your friend.
Say, okay, where did so and so die? I can't remember. Right? You just search for his name or some phrase that you vaguely have in the back of your head, and there it is. And you had to do it on a typewriter.
So what I've done is I've created a Bible. Because my two series then somehow came together, and it's this complete creative mess, which is kind of cool, and on the other hand, it's kind of sloppy. And I just went A, B, C, D, and I've got a file, and I pull up that document, and I have everything listed by A's, and I just do cut, and if a character appears in a book, I just copy it and put it under the correct alphabetical thing, and so far it's working for me. And some people do spreadsheets. Now, I've heard that with the big series, there's a way of creating your own wiki. I have no clue how this works because really I'm a Luddite at heart. But apparently there's a way to create a wiki and you do it privately and keep it to yourself, although some of the bigger authors have actually released their wikis so that readers can go through them. I haven't reached that stage. And I have no idea of how that technically works, but apparently it's very helpful in keeping yourself organized.
So for me, I used to keep it all in my head. And then I found that even on short stories, I was needing to go back to look at people's names. I am horrible with names, by the way. I remember, I'm one of those faces people, and I'm one of those people who, like, I've seen you four or five times at conventions. I'll be like, hi, get down at your bag. Good to see you, Bob. That's me. So even when I write short stories, and we're talking, like, only 4,000 to 5,000 words, I'll forget my character's name halfway through. And I'm just like, crap, page up, page up, page up. And you can't search for it if you don't know what it's called. So, I started creating cheat sheets. And originally what I started was, I started with, for every story I created, I had a cheat sheet next to it, which was just characters' names and like a one-sentence description of like, John, main character. Susan, villain.
That's that was great. You can give that to the copy editor afterwards, and then they're like, hey, have my job done.
Sweet. And then from there it grew, because like I said, I do the in-depth character descriptions before I start writing. And what I started doing was when I did those, I took key sentences over, like key summaries, like the latest book that I'm writing on. I'm like, okay, it's very important for the main character that he had an older brother who was 2 years older, and he died when he was 8 by doing this, because that affects everything he does. So I need to remember that fact. So I'll pull over key things. I'll also pull over hair color, eye color, and weight. That way, I always have it right there, and I never have to search for it.
Yeah.
So that's what I do. So I will have, for every story I create, I will have the Word document which has the story, and I will have another Word document, and I've gotten very good at Alt-Tab when I need to check things.
Yeah, I actually have two monitors, so I'm able to sort of keep one, and I can't go back now. I know, because I go to a single monitor. Isn't that awesome? And I'm able, and it's now when I go to places not two monitors, I'm like always looking to the blank wall. It's there! Hoping that I will create it. Yeah, I know. It's, all right, then I just pull up. I'm a writer. I'm just thinking. Actually, where the hell's my monitor? But so I do the same thing in that I keep, so I have my main manuscript on the main, you know, monitor that I'm working on, and then I will keep my outline, and I do outline now, I didn't used to, on the second monitor. My outlines are a little bit different than your average bear, I think. They are not the sort of Roman numeral 1A, B, you know, all that kind of stuff, because I would have, then I'd be sort of figuring out, was it C that I did? I was like, I don't, right. So what I do instead is I have a chapter-by-chapter outline, which essentially is a paragraph that describes the major facets of each of those chapters and will often bring in aspects of character into those moments. So, especially the first time I introduce them. So, Jaketh Aralok, who is a warden of the Hammers, serving the successor king of the Dovend Empire, blah, 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 blah. All of that stuff is going to appear in the first time that that character appears. Then I don't have to repeat that blah, 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 every time. I could just say Jaketh, and I know who that is, but I can always go back to the first time that they're introduced. And those sort of more narrative outlines as opposed to like bullet point outlines really help me when I need to be able to go back and find these things quickly. But they also sort of capture a little bit of the tone that I'm trying to establish in each chapter. And I'll tell you why that's important. You will often find on a practical level that when you get to the point that you're starting to sell manuscripts and you can even maybe sell something on a proposal as opposed to just selling it on the full manuscript, at some point in the process, lots of editors or agents, if you're working with them, are going to want to see some kind of an outline of the book. And many of them will specifically ask for a chapter-by-chapter outline. Yeah. If you've done it already, that's one less step that you have to do. And it also means that if I'm in chapter 5 and my energy is starting to flag and I'm like, oh, I can't believe this, I'll be like, at one point, Greg, you had 25 chapters outlined. Look, you see it right there on your second monitor that you have. You know, you have all of these other chapters, and you see the way that all of them break down, so you can kind of see the overall narrative arc. So I find that doing an outline like that helps me to maintain not only the plot, but also character information that I wouldn't have otherwise. That said, I think we all could have moments that you described about the tongue thing where, you know, you just, oh, yeah, you mess up, and you're like, you know, like steely gray eyes. I'm like, his eyes are not gray. It would be awesome, because then Steely would make sense, but yeah, they're black eyes, I'm sorry, or they're brown, or they're, you know, or they're green. And so those little sort of details get missed, and that's why it's so important to revise.
Yeah,
but having that outline helps.
Little details like, oh, he's dead.
Little. But have any of you had the main character suddenly change his name without telling anyone halfway through?
No,
but I did have, I wrote, when I was writing Lesser Evils, my book that's coming out in December, I was pregnant for most of it, and then I had a newborn. And I found that I had a little bit of trouble with focusing, and especially during this period where I had morning sickness, I had to take this. It's a sleeping pill that actually helps with not zombie.
Zombies.
Thank you.
Zombies. Also, really very good against zombies. Very good against zombies.
No. But that made me, I would transpose words. I picked words that started with the same letter just randomly, and I did have a problem with just putting in names that weren't even in my book.
Yeah.
So every day when I sat down to write it, I'd go back and have to read what I wrote the day before just to make sure.
Yep.
And there were some doozies.
I've had characters change sex.
That's good.
Really?
Not the hero and heroine, but you know what I'm saying.
Well, but if they both changed, it's
no.
A startling new vision of the future from...
That's okay, because I'm a very strong believer in you have to finish the first draft before you go back and fix.
Yeah.
So my poor writers group will see at the top of the new chapter that I'm submitting to them, oh, by the way, Fred is now Frederica. And she walks with a limp, and they're like, yeah, okay, you're doing it again, aren't you? No, I'm sorry. But we don't have a lot of time. We have about 5 minutes left, so we have some specific questions that anybody wants to ask us or mock us with.
Sir. I have a question for you on the left.
Yes.
You write for Wizards of the Coast, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I think it's my understanding that novels generally focus on the planeswalkers.
That's for Magic, The Gathering.
Oh, okay.
I don't work in Magic, which is good, because that is a lot of very complicated, crazy world.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot over here.
Okay, I'm going to go over here.
How often do you find a problem where the characters sort of come to life and you realize halfway through the story that the character you've built would just kind of say, well, screw that plan and do something entirely different from what you were planning?
Occasionally. I think if you've done an outline, it's less of a surprise.
Yeah, it's less of a surprise, but they can still do it to you.
Sometimes they come up with something and you're like, hey, that's cool.
Sometimes you have secondary characters that are strong and want to take over the book, and you really have to make a conscious effort to say, wait, you'll get your own someday. Just walk back, walk away. And I have this very strong character, Simus. I mean, he just takes over a room when he walks into it, and I'm like, no, no, you can't do this. The hero has to shine. He'll get his own book eventually, but you have to make a conscious effort to push him back, because even though he's your fave, he's not. Now, having said that, if you get halfway through the book and suddenly realize that you want to rewrite the whole book around this new character, my advice would be, no, finish your manuscript, and then on the second draft, make those decisions, because you have to finish a manuscript, people. Can't keep writing the first damn chapter. You have to finish the manuscript.
Feels very strong.
I feel kind of strongly about
that. No, 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 like, get to the end, because that character might fall apart.
Before we go to the next question, I just want to say one thing real quick about that. I find that if you put enough of the analysis into your character beforehand and then plan the outline, they might surprise you in little ways, but you have a good idea of who they are, and they're probably not, at least in my experience, not going a completely different direction. That's all.
No, that's fair.
Yeah.
You touched on it briefly and kind of danced around it, but I was curious for the panel generally, how much work do you put into the antecedents and consequences of the ontology and epistemology generally for the characters to establish that consistent filter of how they react to the artifacts and the culture and the characteristics of the environment?
I got to say that on the first draft, I'm not worried about it. On the first draft, I'm still learning and exploring the story and the characters. That is second draft for me, really. It's very, very much second draft to make sure that they're, because my emotions are all over the page. Sometimes I'm like writing this and the hero's very confident, and then the next page he's like, you know, uncertain, and I'm like, it'll all even out in the end. But that's second draft issues, as far as I'm concerned.
There's a delicate balance, I think, between making sure that, and this is not just characters, making sure that you're prepared enough that the sort of material we were talking about, the ground, sort of the ground game that you've established ahead of time, knowing all the details about the world and the economy and the magic system and all that kind of stuff, and the character. There's a balance between doing that so that you're ready to go and then start writing, and doing so much of it that you never actually start the damn writing. And the problem is, and I've had this came up at a convention a few months ago where someone said, I've got this really great idea, and they went through a fairly elaborate question that was involved, and I think I want to do this, but I'm not sure about this, and we got done to this, and he finished, and we all said, we sort of nodded, and we said, and where's the story?
Yeah.
And the reaction was, you know, and what they had done was produce, as I've said many times before, a source book. It's the source book problem. It makes an awesome encyclopedia, makes a horrible novel. No one wants to have something where they have to be looking in indexes for, like, you know, oh, you know, like here's a chart of all of my characters, you know.
Unless you're that, an incredible, you know, Tolkien fan.
Yeah, but even that is safe for the appendices,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
Hear
you. So what I would say is there's a balance between those two things. I think you need to do, and there's no sort of real hard and fast rule how to do it. I do think you need to think about sort of constructing the characters as much as you can to begin with, to a point. But there's going to be a point where if you think, but what would he do in this very obscure situation, that you do not have to sort of figure out ahead of time. That you have to sort of see how things function within the actual writing, and you have to at some point sit down and write the manuscript.
And honestly, that's part of the pleasure of writing, is the discovery along the way.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you
things,
don't get
yeah.
some pleasure from this, you're going to go absolutely crazy. Definitely. Just saying.
Definitely.
Ma'am?
You said you write in-depth backgrounds about your characters. Do you work from a questionnaire, or do you write prose separate from the novel?
I've seen writers do both. I don't use a questionnaire.
I personally write prose.
Okay.
And then, like I said, when I create my cheat sheets out of my prose. So I will create prose. It is by no means anything that I want anybody to read, because it's scattered thoughts.
Exactly.
It's
yeah.
thoughts are yeah. coming in. But it's just easier for me to just write down the sentences that I think of, then go through and pull out the key parts.
I think that, too, that works a lot better, because then you are asking the questions that character needs. Those questionnaires are kind of interesting places to start from, but a lot of the times, whoever's written that questionnaire is going in a totally different direction.
Right.
Even if you wrote
it's not one size fits
for
all.
One character,
yeah, but
it's
I,
not appropriate for the next character.
I fill out too many forms at the day job already.
real quick, OneNote is awesome for the whole schedule.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. OneNote yes. is fantastic.
And,
Scrivener, too.
You said something that kind of struck a chord with me. It was basically, as I understood it, the story should change the character almost as much as the character changes the story.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Most yeah. definitely. If your character, if especially your main character, whoever your story is about, if you're... Jennifer Brozek said this great in a panel. I'm totally going to steal from her. She's writer, editor, and amazing. She said that if your main character is the same at the beginning and the end, you have given her a scene,
yes.
not a story.
Not mm-hmm. a story.
Yeah.
And an ugly scar does not count as a change.
Ugly scar does not count as a change.
Yeah, the character both shapes and is shaped by the world in very important ways, and being able to see that is important, not just because it works well in fiction, it's actually the way it works well in life. You've heard this phrase about, you know, the man in the moment, or the person that is defined by their times, or defines the times at the same time. Those things really work in a kind of symbiotic relationship. The most interesting way is when it goes back and forth with the same character, where the character is affected by the world in which he or she grows up, then grows up to be able to affect that world in turn, and the results of how they affected the world then return to affect them in the future also. And that yeah. sort of back and forth thing is the way that we work historically. Look at famous figures like Martin Luther King, who was shaped by the conditions in which he, you know, was raised, and then turned to shape the world, and then in both good and sadly tragic ways, shaped his life and the end of it. All of those things make his character interesting in life as much as they do in the book, too.
And I think it's very, very important, especially when you're writing in fantasy, that to a certain extent the world has to be a character as well, which means that the world has to develop too as a result of the story that
yeah.
you're writing. It's one of the factors of fantasy that fantasy readers are looking for. And you have to kind of keep that in the back of your head to show the impact that that the characters are having on the world and the world is having on the characters.
I want to make a quick recommendation for a book where city becomes character. You should read the Hugo-nominated book, The Dervish House by Ian MacDonald, which is one of the most extraordinary descriptions of Istanbul, of any city, it happens to be Istanbul, that you will ever read. It is unbelievable, and it makes that city into its own living, breathing character that arguably is more important than any of the characters that are in the book.
I saw a hand back here.
Yeah. What is your? I was wondering if you guys could comment a moment on incidental characters. You know, those characters that pop up. Oh, he's got to talk to this character. I don't have a name. Blah blah blah. How do you? What do you do about that when these characters show up and?
You try to minimize the amount that they seem as if you were throwing them in incidentally. I was reviewing a show. I review theater shows in New York, and I was reviewing a show called Quest for the Oregon Trail. It's part of the Fringe Festival. Have you ever played the computer game Oregon Trail?
Yeah.
All right. So it's basically a live-action Oregon Trail. It was really cool. And one of the characters is called ASDFJK colon, because the idea is they're just like, I don't know, and they sort of put it out there. That's the definition of an incidental character. Or another one from Galaxy Quest guy, right? The security guard, right? That is sort of the definition of an incidental character, but the best way to do it is to make it appear. If you're very careful about the way you make your main characters so they have fully developed backstories, then you can give small versions of that, and people will buy that that must have a fully developed backstory. So if you can give this person a full name, if you can give them a full name and a title, Shereteth Alacock, the recorder of the empire, or something like that. Now, you may just think to yourself, I'm going to throw out this and this and this, and then they're the recorder of the empire, right? But you know that in the background that they're not going to sort of look behind to see the other side of the so-called two-dimensional set. But they will have trusted, based on all the other work you did on your main characters, that this character will seem developed as well. So you don't need to write a huge sheet for every character.
And we're almost out of time. Yeah. We're almost out of time.
But go ahead. Can I jump on that real quick?
And then I'm going to let Aaron jump.
Avoid tropes. And for the love of all that's holy, make them different. If every single innkeeper sounds the same, it really is not going to seem like you have depth behind them.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying make them sound different by giving them different accents.
No, please don't write dialect. Please just don't. Because it's always bad.
Oh, yeah.
It's not always bad. But so much of the time it's bad.
Did you have some other...
I did. I was going to say those incidental characters, one way to think of them is they're extensions of your setting in a certain sense. That you what you want to portray about that setting can come through if you have, you know, I have a shifty... shopkeeper in Waterdeep, and he's not going to be the same as a shifty shopkeeper. I say that 10 times fast.
Yeah, really.
In Neverwinter, right? That thinking about them that way is one way to make them a little more fleshed out without actually doing a whole lot of fleshing out. And the other way to do that is think about it as an extension of the theme. If a theme is coming out in your story, I think absolutely you should follow it. Your gut is telling you something.
The best piece of advice I ever got about secondary characters was the secondary character's role is to reflect something about the hero and heroine.
Yeah.
And if you use them in that capacity, they build a depth of their own. But you're always reflecting the hero or the heroine in some way, showing us an aspect of the main characters through the secondary characters' responses and actions. Mm-hmm. I'm really sorry we're out of time. We've had a great time. If you still have tickets for this, I really need to have them to prove that this is a popular event at Gen Con. We are also creating a symposium email list. If you're interested in future Gen Cons and the symposium, this is a private email list. The emails will not be released, and they're probably only going to get them about 3 times a year is what I was told to say. So thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Enjoy the con.